You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Brookings. I'm Mike O'Hanlon with the Foreign Policy Program. Thank you for joining us today. It's my privilege to have the Secretary of the Army, Mark Esper, here with us today. Secretary Esper will begin with some prepared remarks, and then he and I will have a conversation, and then we'll go to you. Just a brief word of introduction. I'm really delighted to welcome my good friend back to Brookings. He's now been in this position of Secretary of the Army throughout a good chunk, most of virtually all of the Trump administration. So we're into the 2.5-year mark as we approach the summer of 2019. He's a soldier, served in Operation Desert Storm, graduated from West Point before that in 1986, has also served on Capitol Hill, including with Senator Bill Frist, and has also worked in industry. So he really understands the U.S. national security establishment from every possible vantage point. And together with General Milley, incoming chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, we suspect, Senate confirmation pending. He has run the Army now in a remarkable way and really put a big imprint on it during these 2.5 years so far of the Trump administration, including with the creation of Futures Command, the so-called night court proceedings that have really tried to streamline and prioritize the Army, six major concepts for technology modernization, and all the while trying to build a strong and stronger all-volunteer force. And so we'll hear more about this today, and I want you to please join me in welcoming the Secretary of the Army to Brookings.
Good. Thanks, Michael. I really appreciate that introduction. And good morning to everyone. It's great to be back here at the Brookings Institution. You know, when I was here last in June, we had a great conversation about the Army vision of 2028, which General Milley and I had just issued. And so here we are coming up on a year now. That vision really outlined the type of force needed to prevail against great power competitors in the future. And I know we're going to have a conversation about that today. Now, to get there, the Army vision proposed several bold changes in the way we do business. Things like developing unmanned combat vehicles and aircraft, writing new warfighting doctrine, training differently, and redesigning our personnel system. Now, less than 1 year later, we see the elements of our vision taking shape. We unified our modernization enterprise by standing up Army Futures Command, as Michael mentioned, down in Austin, Texas. Our cross-functional teams now report to General Mike Murray, the AFC commander, and are laser-focused on the Army's six modernization priorities. We published Multi-Domain Operations 1.5 as our new warfighting concept. And as we continue to experiment with our multi-domain task force, we are working to turn the concept into doctrine and eventually into a construct that will drive a redesign of our warfighting formations. We have revamped our recruiting and accessions enterprise to better enable the Army to attract our nation's most qualified youth. Our training is focused on high-intensity conflict against near-peer threats with modern capabilities, and we are reforming our personnel system to create a marketplace for talent that will allow us to better utilize our people while holding on to the best of them. These are just a few of the items we are working on, and none of this would be possible without a solid strategy guiding our way. The National Defense Strategy has provided us with clear strategic direction needed to drive these reforms. Unlike previous strategies, the NDS has staying power, and our Army vision and Army strategy fit right in with the direction the NDS is taking us. Any good strategy must first answer the why behind it. And for the NDS, it's about the threat. You are all well aware of the global security environment and the threats we face around the world. Our strategic competitors, namely China and Russia, are rapidly modernizing their militaries. For almost two decades, we have been focused on the Middle East at the expense of preparing for the future. China and Russia have not. The U.S. military's across-the-board overmatch that we held since the end of the Cold War has been steadily eroded. In traditional capabilities such as combat vehicles, artillery, long-range fires, and air defense, we are still fighting with systems from the 1980s, when I joined the service, while our adversaries are prototyping and, in some cases, fielding new equipment. In the emerging cyber and space domains, we find ourselves having to constantly defend our networks and systems against sophisticated competitors, who carefully act below the threshold of armed conflict. To counter all this, we must modernize, and we must do so now. Failure to move beyond the status quo risks defeat in the first battles of the next war. Our hope, of course, is that we don't have to fight that war. As George Washington said back in 1790, quote, "To be prepared for war is one of the most effectual means of preserving peace," unquote. Although said in the context of his era, Washington's message is timeless. In today's age of hyper-competition, the Army's first role is to provide a conventional deterrent to our strategic competitors. For deterrence to work, though, we must have the warfighting capability required to defeat our adversaries on the field of battle, if necessary. The Army's modernization is central to our ability to do just that. Now, to bolster deterrence, the Army continues to deploy forces across our priority theaters, Europe and the Indo-Pacific. In Europe, we keep an armored brigade combat team on heel-to-toe deployments to train with our allies and partners across the region. This past March, we conducted a no-notice deployment of more than 1,500 soldiers from the 1st Armored Division, who drew equipment from our pre-positioned stocks and conducted 3 weeks of training in Poland. This is one example of how we are operationalizing the dynamic force employment strategy outlined in the National Defense Strategy. Additionally, we are planning a major division-level exercise, Defender 2020, that will take place in Europe next year. In the Indo-Pacific, we are increasing the duration of our Pacific Pathways exercise with our allies and partners throughout the region. We are also continuing to experiment with our multi-domain task force and are learning a lot about the right mix of capabilities needed to fight in a multi-domain environment. As part of our latest evolution of the task force, we recently stood up the newly created I2Qs battalion. Now, so for whoever's reporting on this, I2Q stands for Intelligence, Information, Cyber, Electronic Warfare, and Space. And in 2021, we are planning to conduct a division-level defender exercise in the Pacific. Our increased focus in this region is allowing us to contest the competitive space with China while improving interoperability with our allies and partners. To ensure the Army remains capable, a capable deterrent well into the future, we need the budgetary predictability to sustain our readiness gains and to fund our modernization strategy. Last month, Undersecretary Ryan McCarthy was here to discuss the FY20 budget request. Now, I won't repeat the details of the budget, but as you saw, we are making a bold shift towards the future. To pay for these new systems, things like long-range precision fires, a next-generation combat vehicle, and future vertical lift helicopters, we canceled, reduced, or delayed nearly 200 programs, several of which are legacy systems that have reached the end of their life or are not well-suited for the future fight. As many of you know, canceling a program is often harder than starting a new one. Understandably, many members of Congress focus on the local impacts to their districts. Defense companies that are affected start to push back. Some expect their programs to go on forever. But what is often ignored is the $30 billion in new opportunity that will be available over the next few years. You know, I meet with defense CEOs on a regular basis, and my message to them is to meet us in the future. Help the Army modernize rather than fight to hold on to the past. The Army needs a robust industrial base, and we too are concerned about preserving a skilled workforce. But we are also not running a jobs program. The best way for our industry partners to remain healthy is by developing the systems we need to fight and win in the future. It was evident to me during our recent posture hearings on the Hill that there is strong bipartisan support for the Army's reforms and for our budget. I'm sure there will be continued debate about the final DOD top-line number, but by and large, most members agreed with the path that the Army is on. What will jeopardize our momentum, however, is a failure to provide the funding we need and to provide it on time. For 9 out of the last 10 years, we've had to begin the year under a continuing resolution. We've spent a lot of time recently explaining to Congress the harm that CRs cause to the Army. For example, they prohibit planned new starts and prevent us from executing any production rate increases. The longer we operate under a CR, the less time we have to efficiently spend our resources as well. And we can't ever get that lost time back. It's not as if you can surge resources into training or researching new systems. Those opportunities have already been lost. It's like telling some members of your team to skip spring training, don't buy the new equipment, even though you know you have games ahead on your schedule. Even worse yet would be a relapse back into sequestration. This would be catastrophic for the Army. The readiness gains we've made over the past couple years, with over a 55% improvement in our brigade combat team readiness since 2016, would be lost, and our modernization efforts would be halted. Training would be reduced to platoon level, combat training center rotations would be canceled, and the vital work done by our CFTs would be put on hold. I think that everyone understands this would be a disaster. So I would ask you for your assistance to help support the Army's message. I know change is hard, and not all will ever get on board, but we must make the transition. We must leave the past and rush to the future. We must follow the NDS and prepare for what could be the most challenging military showdown of the 21st century. The Army senior leaders have thought long and hard about the decisions we have made, and I'm confident they are the right ones. The world is a complex and dangerous place, and we're doing everything we can to be ready for it. We must stay ahead. We must retain overmatch. We must deter conflict and keep the peace. With an on-time appropriations bill in FY20, we will continue to build readiness and start to modernize the force so that we are prepared to fight and win when our nation calls. Thank you, and I look forward to our discussion this morning.
Mr. Secretary, thank you. And if I could, I wanted to pick up right where you left off on the issue of the potential budget impasse, which there's no particular reason to get too worried about yet. It's April 30th. Except that history tells us we should start worrying as early as possible. And we know that the configuration of forces in Washington is such that it's very hard to predict where this is headed. I know you spent a fair amount of the spring on Capitol Hill. Do you have a sense, anything more you can tell us about ideas that recognizing confidentiality prevents perhaps telling us everything? Are there some ideas that are germinating about how a compromise could be fashioned between the Democrats and the Republicans on the 2020 budget?
You know, my crystal ball doesn't work that well. We remain very hopeful. I think one of the things we push for, of course, is, the budget we proposed, naturally. It'd be great to have a two-year deal and to get the bills done on time. As I said in my remarks, the impacts that a CR has on us is just devastating in terms of lost opportunities. And particularly when you're trying to start new programs, or if you have to change production rates on munitions, those simply are not available if you're under a continuing resolution. So we continue to push and make the case on the need to get a budget agreement, a deal done soon. And then, obviously the committees, I think the defense committees are anxious to get that number also so they can move out. And I think they equally want to get a bill done on time, bills done on time.
My understanding is, and I've been trying to learn more about this, but CRs even can affect maintenance in the sense that you would think, well, a CR provides the same resources as last year. Everybody believes in maintenance. It's not a new start. So couldn't that at least be unaffected? But I've come to appreciate that some of the longer term 6 and 12 month contracts that you might do with a private company are precluded under many CR kind of stipulations. Is that a fair way to understand the problem?
I mean, I think everything is bound by last year's budget because it is a continuing resolution. So if you have an uptick in maintenance demands, you may be unable, because you don't want to violate the Deficiency Act or anything like that, unable to purchase what you need in order to keep things running. So yes, and of course, if you have maintenance issues, if you can't buy parts, that is a direct factor into the readiness rate of your brigade combat teams. Is the equipment ready to roll out the door to combat?
So I want to talk a little bit about modernization priorities, knowing how much that's been a centerpiece of your efforts. But before I do, I also wanted to talk briefly about recruiting and the state of the all-volunteer force. And a lot of people are aware that in 2018, the Army did not fully meet its recruiting goals. I know you're somewhat concerned about that, but you're not pressing the panic button, if I understand correctly. Could you explain a little bit more about how you see the state of Army recruiting and retention and the overall, health of the all-volunteer force?
Yeah, I think just start from last year, and General Milley spoke very eloquently about this during our appearances before Congress. You know, first things first, we had a very high mark to begin with, 76,500 soldiers. We came up short, if you will, at 70,000. Why? As General Milley would explain it, we had a stretch goal. The stretch goal was 76,500. We still came out at 70,000 soldiers, which is the highest number we recruited in 10 years. Mm. So still a great number. We did it with quality.
because in the summer I'd raised the standards in a number of different areas. At the same time, what also fell off the radar screen is the fact that I think we had one of our highest retention rates ever, 86% or so for the regular Army, I'm sorry, for the entire Army, and over 90%, if memory serves me right, with regard to the regular Army. So what it tells you is those soldiers who are in are very satisfied with their careers in the Army, what we're offering, and have bought in, if you will. That said, we took note of the miss, and what we did was look at our entire recruiting and accessions enterprise, put a single four-star general in charge, and then through a number of initiatives with a new commander at U.S. Army Recruiting Command, we did everything from add hundreds of recruiters to the force. We're updating our websites, our back office software, how we message in terms of social media. I mean, there are about two dozen initiatives we've done. How do you upgrade your storefronts, in some cases move them? And probably the biggest thing we've done is we adopted a new approach called our Focus 22 Cities, where we are going back to America's largest 22 cities and going to speak to kids, reach out to them where they are, and really expand the aperture. So I've been to Cleveland and Pittsburgh and L.A., and just last week I was in Atlanta talking to governors and mayors and school superintendents about how we can open more doors, get into more schools, and talk to kids. Because if we don't go to where the young men and women are, all the services can continue to find ourselves in a shortfall. Why? Because the bigger trend out there is the fact that only 29% of America's youth age 17 to 24 qualify in the first place for service because of either cognitive, behavioral, medical, or physical fitness issues. And then if you look at that same cohort and you apply also the factor of qualified and, number two, have a propensity to serve, your number is less than 4%. So we have a small pool. So we got to get out there and talk to kids, make sure they understand who we are and what we are. And because with a country of 330 million people, we should be able to fill the ranks of the all-volunteer force with quality, with quality.
I wanted to ask about, you know, if you do in the future get those additional recruiters and a greater proclivity to serve somehow, or if there's some other partial breakthrough that increases your ability to add numbers, how big do you want to get? And the reason I ask is that we know from recent speeches and doctrine and other kinds of articles that the Air Force and the Navy are still very ambitious, at least in theory, about how much bigger they want to get. Mm-hmm. By the way, I don't say that necessarily with approval, because I think that going for much greater quantity can run counter to going for quality or for modernization, as Jim Miller and I have written. But the Air Force and the Navy both technically want to grow their force structure about 25%. The Air Force came up with a plan last year to go from 312 to 386 squadrons. The Navy still is aiming for 355 ships when they're around 285 now, I think. And so these are big expansions. Now, the budget doesn't actually get them very far, the 2020 proposal. Your budget seems more in line with, frankly, reality. And but I'm putting all this on the table to ask you to comment. If you could get bigger, how much bigger do you want to get? And how much is a larger force structure a real vision or goal of the Army longer term?
Very good question. So, first of all, we need to be able to meet the needs of the National Defense Strategy. And number two, we need to do it with a quality force. Again, we're not going to sacrifice quality for quantity. In the vision that we put out last year, we said that we want a force of greater than 500,000 soldiers with associated growth in the Guard and Reserve. I'm very comfortable with that number because I know we need to be above 500,000. But the answer to your question will not be really known for about another year or year and a half. And why is that? Because what we have now, Futures Command is doing, is working through all the scenarios of future warfare, what the environment may look like in 2030, what potential adversaries may field, how they may field it, and then what do we plan on fielding? And we know what they are, long-range precision fires, next-generation combat vehicle, all those things. And then we fight them. We run war games. And that entire process, when you inject it in the underneath the construct of multi-domain operations, it's going to spit out a new warfighting construct, and that will really inform us whether in the future we fight as BCTs, we fight at the division level, maybe we fight at some new level of command that we just haven't thought of yet, and then will also tell us, you know, how many companies or battalions in each, and so I think at that point in time we'll have a better sense of what we need to fight and win a future conflict against a strategic competitor looks like, and how we will fight that by formation. And then from there, we'll know how many people we need to fill out those formations. And then, of course, you have to put in a dose of reality in terms of
well, what can you afford to do with quality soldiers? Can you acquire the quality soldiers you need to field that force? And what will the budget allow? And so I think, again, I think we're another probably 18 months away from understanding what that number is. It could be 500,000, it could be 504,000, it could be 540,000, it could be 580,000. We just don't know yet. We want to do the math and make sure we have a really good understanding of what it will take, and then we'll proceed from there.
When General Goldfein was here at Brookings a few months ago, he did a public event with us as well, and I asked him to explain more as well as he could publicly in an unclassified forum what drove the national defense strategy and national military strategy in terms of pressing scenarios. And you just talked about the analysis you're doing, but he laid out a list where we needed to protect the homeland, including with missile defense.
Right.
We needed to sustain a strong nuclear deterrent with all the capabilities like refueling aircraft on standby, even if we're doing something else with the conventional force. We need the conventional overmatch against Russia or China, being able to defeat either one of them,
right,
but not both simultaneously, right, in a all-out conventional fight. So that was the third piece, homeland, nuclear, conventional fight. And then he said, maintain deterrence of North Korea, presumably also maintain deterrence of the other superpower, but he didn't say that explicitly, and then sustain momentum in the war on terror.
Right.
So is that five-point list, is that essentially where the Army's coming from as well, or do you have a somewhat different way of phrasing
that? That sounds like basically my recollection of what the National Defense Strategy tells us, and you rightly put out that we have to maintain a competence in irregular warfare. And I think the other thing that we all have to factor in, too, is leveraging the strength of the United States military, and that is fighting as a joint force. And for the Army, we also fight as a total army. So it's not just the regular Army going to war. It's the regular Army, the Guard, and Reserves. So we have to think about how we fight in the future as a total army in a joint force. And when you think about multi-domain operations, and what that means for us is how can we support the Navy in a naval fight, right, with long-range precision fires, with our very capable air defense systems, or how do we also support the Air Force, which we've done before under air-land battle, which is the doctrine when I came into the Army in 1986 was first introduced, where we used the suppression of enemy air defenses was a critical role for our long-range fires. And so we need to think then, how do we also leverage in the future the Army's cyber capabilities to fight in the domain called cyber, and then how do we fight in space, all that. So I think we have to look at all that together to make sure that we got the right force we need for the future fight.
I want to ask a question about training and then get to modernization. But first, you mentioned multi-domain operations just now and in your opening remarks. And I think a lot of people are sort of impressed by the concepts, but maybe a little hazy on exactly what this concept means. It seems to be fairly broad. It's pretty inclusive. Mm-hmm. Air-land battle was, I think, a little more specific. Maybe that was the luxury we had in the late 70s, early 80s, focused on one Warsaw Pact threat to Europe as our main concern. But today you've got a lot of things to worry about. Can you explain both at a conceptual level how you would give a short answer about what is multi-domain operations? And also some people wonder, is this something that the Army is driving primarily? To what extent are you getting really strong support and interest from the other services? Or do they see it as primarily an Army or Army Air Force thing?
Yeah, so it's a good question. I'll kind of do the best I can and contrast it with air-land battle. So air-land battle, which was introduced in 1986, which was, you know, our warfighting doctrine to take on the Soviets in Europe at the time, specifically Germany, air-land was two domains, air and land. Now we've added multi-domain, which has added three more. So air-land, but then also sea, and then cyber and space. Now, you know, my recollection from my days in the Army, we didn't think much about how do we support the Navy in a maritime operation. But now, particularly when you look west towards a future fight or potential fight in the Pacific, we have to think about that. How would we fight in the Western Pacific? How do we support that fight? And of course, 30 years ago, we didn't have cyber. But clearly that's evident now. The Army has put a lot of money into its cyber soldiers, cyber officers, our cyber abilities, and we actually are running offensive and defensive operations today. So clearly that's a place where our adversaries will go and have gone, right? They're operating currently below that threshold of armed conflict. So cyber's there in space. Again, 30 years ago, I don't think space was nearly contested as it is now. So we have to support the United States. We have to make sure we can defend across all those domains and support our sister services. So that's where it's practical. I'll tell you, we're working very closely with the Air Force on this. We discuss it with the other services as well, and I think there's a lot of buy-in as we use that concept to inform our wargaming and, again, eventually what our force will look like in the future.
One question on the threats that you've alluded to that we have to worry about as we plan. And then, as I say, I do want to segue into training and then get back to modernization. I realize that you have a lot on your plate, mostly recruiting, retaining, training, sustaining the Army. But I know you're watching threats, and you just alluded to them. In the last 12 to 24 months, anything that you would say of particular note that struck you about the evolution of Russian behavior in Europe or Russian military modernization, and then to some extent also, of course, North Korea, but anything that's particularly instructive to you as you think about the future threat? Because we all watched what happened in 2014, 15, 16, seizure of Crimea, China's greater assertiveness in the South China Sea. A lot of developments seemed to happen in those years. And then the last couple of years, obviously the world's remained chaotic and tense, but we haven't seen a fundamentally new aggression. And since the 2018 mini detente with North Korea, things seem a little calmer there. But I wondered how you looked at the overall set of threats, and especially Russia and North Korea.
Well, we study them carefully, and there's stuff that we've talked about in the open, and there's much more in the classified realm. But we study adversaries, and not just what they're doing, but where they're going and what they're researching. And you've heard others say before about how much adversaries are putting into, or potential adversaries are putting into, hypersonics and artificial intelligence and things like that. And in some areas, we are behind. So we're playing a game of catch-up. When you look at what the Army's investing in, if I had to name a few technologies, it would be artificial intelligence, robotics, hypersonics, and directed energy. Things that just jump off the top of my head. So we watch them well. We study. We want to make sure, as I spoke earlier about wargaming, we can project forward where they might be, and therefore where do we have to be in order to retain that overmatch. And all the lessons we've seen from Russia and Ukraine and elsewhere, we incorporate back into our training center. The National Training Center and others, scenarios. So our forces now operate on high-intensity conflict against what we might see from a near-peer competitor in either a battle that could take place tomorrow or in 10 or 15 years. And at the same time, it's not just a doctrinal, but how do we develop, again, the tools, the training to make sure we can deal with that?
And that leads to my question on training, which I've been promising. So here it is. When I first started to see, I think in the latter Obama years, the Army getting focused, and when General Milley was a new chief at that time, getting focused on going back to the National Training Centers and doing the sort of classic maneuver warfare kinds of exercises that we hadn't been doing in the previous 10 to 15 years, I had this image of going back to the kind of training that, let's say, you did when you were a new Army soldier in the late 80s. But then, as I've appreciated from your comments, Undersecretary McCarthy, others, I realize actually you're doing things much differently than you were in the late 80s, early 90s, given the nature of all these different technologies. Can you highlight a couple of things that are different about what you ask your forces to do in those training rotations to make the exercises realistic and responsive to the threat environment of today?
Yeah, sure thing. I mean, first things first, much credit goes to General Milley for leading the Army, kind of moving us back toward a stronger readiness posture focused on high-intensity conflict. And, the NDS just came out last year this time, January of last time. So the NDS was easy for us to embrace. We already believed that that was where we should be and had already begun moving there. So that's why you see we're such enthusiastic supporters of it. We're certainly willing to make big choices and bold moves to do that. But, yes, I'd been to the training centers a couple times when I was an officer. I've been there now twice to the NTC, to JRTC, and to our site in Hohenfels. And I will tell you, if you go out there right now, what I didn't see 30 years ago, for example, is our soldiers either defending against enemy drones or employing our own drones to do anything from surveillance to direct fires. So you see that. We also challenge them to move much more frequently. So this concept of staying in a fixed spot for 4 or 5 or 6 days is gone. It's now they have to, what we call, jump their operation centers every 12 hours or so, and even that is not quick enough. So we see the need for, in order to be survivable on the battlefield, they have to be able to move much more quickly around the battlefield. They have to be also able to either mask or obscure their electronic signals, and then by the same token, be able to use electronic warfare to detect or jam the enemy. That's something we largely took out of our formations of the past 20 years. And then we mentioned the drones. So there's more we could talk about, but those are just three good examples of when you go out to the National Training Center, what you would see today that is different than 30 years ago.
And in terms of what's different from maybe 3 or 4 years ago, have we started to mitigate any of these most severe vulnerabilities in terms of cyber attack, electronic warfare, many of the things that I know you and the general have been concerned about in terms of a high-end fight, especially against Russia and Europe. Have we gotten the forces accustomed, either improve their resilience in the cyber system so that they're less vulnerable to hacking, or improve their ability to operate with some of those systems malfunctioning and just expecting that some of the CQ die could be taken down, command and control won't work as well. Have we mitigated some of those vulnerabilities over the last 3 or 4 years?
Yes, I think we're making good progress, and depending on a system, some better than others. But we do need to keep investing in those technologies. But at the same time, there are other ways to mitigate that. We have tactics, techniques, and procedures, as we like to say. So, as I've gone around to, I was at Fort Sill a couple months ago at the artillery school. I was at Fort Benning last year at the infantry school. And at Fort Sill, I said, are you guys able to shoot your cannons, run fire missions without using your computers? And they said, yes, sir. We practice all the time. And I said, spot on, because, in future warfare, chances are the best you will have are intermittent communications. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the infantry. Can you navigate without having a GPS? Do you know how to pull out your compass and go from point A to point B? And the answer, again, is yes. And that's what our vision emphasizes, and making sure that you can also, optimize the technology we have available, but still function in a world where you don't have access to that. And by the way, it's not just, being jammed. It could be you run out of battery power. It's simple things that you don't want to neutralize your own force because you haven't prepared for it. So that's why the training piece becomes very difficult.
I wanted to just touch on a couple of the modernization priorities in your six areas, your six cross-functional teams. And maybe, if you don't mind, we could start with vertical lift. And I'm just curious, we've seen the Marines, of course, get the V-22 Osprey working pretty well. I know that there are some concepts for how the Army might move in a similar kind of direction for at least some elements of future vertical lift. But I wanted to just hear you talk about the promises, the perils, where we stand in this broad zone of technology.
Yeah, sure. It's a very good question. In fact, I'll use your earlier question to tee up my answer. So you said if we were to go back in time to the 1980s, what would the National Training Center and exercise look like there compared to today? And one thing I would say it hasn't changed is if you were to go to the NTC today and stand on an overlook and watch a fight, you will still see Abrams tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles and Black Hawk helicopters and Apache helicopters and Chinooks and the whole rigmarole. And it just talks to you about how old our systems are. That doesn't mean they're not capable. It just means that we need to get to the next generation, right? And some systems are in better shape than others. But to an untrained eye, you would see 1986 would look similar to 2019. It's just that simple. So, yes, on aviation, so it's a great example. When you think about the national defense strategy and what we face, we know that we need to upgrade our aviation capabilities, our portfolio. So our number one priority, what we need first and foremost, is an attack reconnaissance capability. That's an aircraft that has the speed, the range, the survivability to penetrate robust air defense systems, get deep behind the enemy, and to do a number of things, either employ drones or call for fires or direct other aircraft, but to clear the airspace, if you will. And that's why what we call FARA, the Future Attack Reconnaissance Aircraft, is our number one priority. The second is what we call FLRAA, Future Long Range Assault Aircraft. That's the replacement for the Black Hawk, if you will. Same characteristics. I need greater speed. I need greater range, payload, et cetera, survivability. And both these systems now, the demonstrators we've seen out there are showing tremendous, tremendous capability on both fronts. So that would be number two. Number three is we need to think about what's the future of heavy vertical lift, right? So what's the future replacement for the Chinook that gives me survivability in a fight against, say, Russia or China that has the speed, the range, maybe greater payload to do those things? So that's how I think about it. And in order to pay for that, we looked at the entire aviation portfolio and said, if I have a capability I don't have right now called FARA, and I have another one, number two, FLRAA, which needs upgraded. So I got to pull resources out of the existing inventory from somewhere else in order to make sure I can get there by 2028 for start deploying these new aircraft. So that's the game plan, and that's the reason why. It's, again, driven by the National Defense Strategy, those key characteristics we need to be able to operate in a very robust air defense environment. And not just air defense, too. You're talking about potential adversaries who have very capable fixed-wing aircraft. And so that's our thinking right there.
That's great. I wanted to ask about vehicles, too, and specifically tanks. And, of course, this is a touchy subject for the Army, given the debacle or the difficulty with the Future Combat System a decade or so ago. But I wanted to ask you to update us now on how you think about the future of heavy vehicles. Yeah. I think the Army is still putting a fair amount of money in the 2020 proposal into refurbishing M1 tanks, if I understand right. I wondered if you could explain that. Is that seen sort of as a bridging to get us to a capability that you envision any particular time? Could you just talk a little bit about the future of the tank?
No, sure thing. So I'll back up a little bit. Again, when we think about the Army, we need to take on future adversaries near peer. Some of the things we're doing, for example, are converting units. So we've converted an IBCT to an infantry brigade combat team to an armored brigade combat team. And we're thinking about, do we need a 17th armored brigade combat team? Because that's the type of unit you need to be really capable against a Russia or China. But with regard to the M1 itself, it's a very capable tank, and it has room for upgrade. We're upgrading them now, the SEP 3. I was in Lima just several weeks ago walking the line. But it's a tank with a great deal of capability, good deal of life still left in it, great fire control, protection, you name it. It's the most lethal tank on the battlefield today and will be for many years to come. At some point, we will have to upgrade it. But right now, our focus is on the Bradley. The Bradley, in many ways, has run out of upgrade room. So electrical power, automotive power, things like that that we can put on it just isn't there anymore. So that's why our top priority when we talk about next generation combat vehicle is replacing the Bradley. And we have a number of companies that are going to, work on this, that are lining up for it. But I have to get that first because, again, the upgradeability is not there. And I need a system that can ferry troops into combat with the tanks, that can then dismount and do what infantry, typically does. And as we look at this, we've put some objective requirements in there to make sure that we have the lethality built into the system to take on, near-peer threats like vehicles and also survivability. So one of the things, we're building into this is active protective systems, which the Bradley has a hard time powering right now. But active protective systems will be the key to the future because we just can't keep putting armor upon armor and making these vehicles more and more heavy.
And that was sort of the hope with the future combat system. Maybe it was just an idea whose time hadn't yet come in the sense that the technology couldn't quite deliver the goods back in 2000, 2005, but now you're getting closer.
Yeah, so, the approach now that we've taken is fundamentally different in many ways. We talked about Futures Command. It gives us clear unity of effort and unity of command in terms of modernizing. But just the process whereby we're engaging a lot more with industry, I think, in terms of requirements. We're willing to make trade-offs. The Chief of Staff and I get briefed every Monday by a different cross-functional team. There's only like two layers between the cross-functional team, or one layer between them and me. It's called General Murray. Mm-hmm. And we're constantly, looking at requirements, willing to make trade-offs. We want to get the best system we can with the technology we have today, and then build into the vehicles and all the systems, where it's vehicles, aircraft, you name it, room for growth, either from electrical power or space on the vehicle. And you do that by building modularity into it, by making sure you have the right IP and intellectual property constructs and things like that. But we want to continually upgrade and integrate the vehicles and not reach for something that is years away. We want to do it now, and so we're confident that we can get, the next generation combat vehicle out by 2028.
So I just have one more question, but it's going to combine two areas. I realize that it's time to let the rest of you enjoy this conversation as well and be part of it. But I wanted to talk about hypersonics and directed energy together. And the way I'll combine is to put the following premise on the table and see how you react. I've heard Ryan McCarthy and others and yourself express a lot of positive thinking and hopefulness about hypersonics,
right,
and seeing some real opportunity there. I'm a little bit more wary myself about the near to medium term future of directed energy. It seems like it might be able to help us in certain very specific tactical settings, but the idea of building a laser big enough to, let's say, provide area missile defense is still quite a ways off, whereas being able to potentially protect a specific vehicle with an active system, maybe that's a little bit closer, whether it's for a Bradley. I think the Israelis are already doing it. In fact, we're starting to experiment with some of these kind of systems on fighter jets. So it looks like in directed energy, to me, and please correct me if you see it differently, we're doing better at having some prospects for near-term protection of the vehicle, but laser technology or other directed energy systems are still quite a ways off being able to provide area missile defense, whether cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, what have you. And hypersonics do seem promising. So do you sort of size up that portfolio of technologies in a similar way to how I just laid it out?
Yes, on hypersonics, we think it's a system we need in order to get the distance, the standoff we need to really deliver long-range precision fire. So we see hypersonics as key, for example, to our strong strategic long-range cannon. And we're working very closely with the other services on that. Secretary Wilson and Spencer and I have a deal in terms of sharing technologies and ideas and resources to do that. So we're going to make good progress there. Directed energy, I will tell you, we're much further along than you might think. We're going to deploy mobile short-range air defenses in Europe beginning next year. And so that's very exciting. We're restoring air defense, maneuverable air defense, back to our heavy units. That's a big deal, a really big deal for us, given the threats. And in terms of where the technology is going, we are very close to having a deployable system that can knock down drones and small aircraft, things like that. It'll be very exciting. Now, directed energy isn't the answer to everything. Why? Because there are certain situations where you can't use it, right? A dust storm, fog, things like that, where the beam is attenuated, if you will, or disrupted. But in most cases, it is. It's very usable because what it gives you is, you know, it gives you pennies on the dollar per shot as compared to using a missile. And it gives you repeatability. If you have the right power and the right storage, you can just use that magazine over and over and over as compared to using missiles. So I imagine you'll see lasers deployed in the next few years. But they will be deployed on vehicles alongside traditional missiles and maybe guns.
Yeah.
Because you're going to need a variety of capabilities in order to deal with a variety of air threats.
That's a fantastically good and concise briefing on a number of technologies, so thank you. But I'm now going to share the fun with you. So please, when you get called on, please wait for a microphone, identify yourself, and we'll go from there. We'll start here in the third row, please, all the way up to the front. Sydney.
Hi, Sydney Friedberg, Breaking Defense. There's a lot happening. You mentioned with FVL, for example, on the Big Six, which now have manifested as 31 individual initiatives, and that number may wobble. The flip side is something I've heard occasionally that unlike FCS, these are not all in lockstep. If one link in the link breaks, the whole chain doesn't break because they're not mutually dependent in the same way. Are you guys adopting a fail fast methodology?
Yes.
Yeah, so at what point do we start getting feedback like, okay, this works, proceed, this doesn't work, we may actually have to kick that one to the curb and try something totally different for that priority in the Big Six or of the 31?
Yeah, no, it's fail fast, fail cheap, right? So, and you learn from failure, and part of what we're doing too is trying to change the culture within the Army so that if you're doing all the right things and you fail fast, that's fine, but what's the lessons learned so you can kind of you can move forward on in the next approach. And you're right, they're not all linked together. So I told you a few minutes ago that for future vertical lift, our number one priority is FARA, and our number two is FLRAA. But I'm not going to hold back FLRAA or FARA in order to maintain that sequencing. I'm just telling you in terms of resources and attention and everything else how we think through it, because I need to give clear guidance for folks. So, yeah, they're not linked, and we want to fail early, fail fast. But I'm not telling people to fail early. Let's succeed early, and so that's kind of. And we've seen a lot of success so far. So the enhanced night vision goggles will come out here in a few months. That was a quick turn in terms of soldier lethality. You saw we just let five awards the other day in terms of our FARA aircraft. That was we did that within 13 months, and that was 2 months ahead of schedule. So it gives you a sense of how much more quickly we're moving these days. And we had five good companies who are competing to make the down select, and then we can go across in terms of a number of other modernization priorities where we're seeing a lot of good progress.
That's great. So we'll stay right here and go to the fourth row, please.
Sir, George Nicholson with the Global Special Operations Forces Foundation. About a year ago, Bob Work gave a briefing over here at SICE and said the biggest problems we've got in the Pentagon are the three tribes: modernization at all costs, readiness at all costs, and the worst tribe is force structure at all costs. We'll never be able to achieve all three. I think you're alluding to that you and the Chief of Staff of the Army are making the difficult decisions of looking at current legacy systems and everything else we need to trade. I see the pushback. Secretary McCarthy has talked about going ahead and terminating or stopping the acquisition of CH-47s. I see the huge pushback on that, of the impact that that's going to have on communities. Any comments about where you see that's going? Are you going to be successful in reducing that so that you can pay for the future aviation systems?
Sure. You know, it's I didn't hear Bob Work's speech, but I wouldn't – those wouldn't have been my three tribes. I actually think we – you know, we take a very conscious, deliberate look at how we balance readiness and modernization. And in my thinking and the chief's thinking, it's readiness and future readiness, and we have to be able to do both. And that's why I think we're taking a very pragmatic approach and then managing risk where we need to manage risk. You know, the CH-47s, look, they're very good aircraft. I have a lot of hours in the back of a CH-47. And we will continue to buy CH-47s for the special operations community. But we are halting procurement for the conventional Army. And it's not a statement on, again, on the aircraft or the company's performance. What it is a statement on the fact that, as I outlined earlier, our priorities with regard to what we need for the future fight are far off. What I don't have right now in my inventory of aircraft is an aircraft built, dedicated to doing future attack reconnaissance mission, number one. Number two, I gotta replace the Black Hawk. And then I mentioned future heavy vertical lift. The issue with the CH-47s is the fact is I've met my acquisition objective with spares to spare. And most of these aircraft are somewhere between 6 to 8 years old on average. They're going to be with me for another 20, 30 years. So, you know, the first ones were built, I think, in 1962. So we like to talk about how old the B-52 is, right? But we've had the CH-47 for a long time. What I want to do is I want the rotorcraft industry, or industry, if you will, to start thinking about what is the future of heavy vertical lift. And what might that system look like? It may be a version of the CH-47. I don't know. But what does future heavy vertical look like? And I need an aircraft that can survive in that domain in the future. I need it that has greater speed, greater range, greater payload, because I can't have FARA and FLRAA zipping down the battlefield. And meanwhile, you know, our other aircraft in the inventory just can't keep up or are more vulnerable. So that's how we're thinking about it. And like I said, I think we have a very good fleet right now. They'll be with us for a long time. Confident we can sustain it. But my next ask of the aviation community within, you know, for rotorcraft will be, what's the future of heavy vertical lift?
Excellent. Let's see where we can go. Go over here to the woman in the fifth row, please.
Hi, sir. Haley Britsky with Task and Purpose. You briefly spoke about the quantity of the force and how you all are kind of evaluating that. On that note, I believe last week, a war game at the Marine Corps War College estimated that in the first week of a conflict with Russia and China, the U.S. and its allies would see about 150,000 losses in that first week. Is that in line at all with the Army's thinking? And if so, how are you preparing for that? And what kind of steps are you taking towards being ready for something like that?
Yeah, I haven't seen you know, that study, obviously, and wouldn't want to convey anything we've seen or learned. I mean, it's, you always hear those numbers. I do believe that any conflict with a competitor such as a Russia and China would be very violent and very quick in many ways. And so that's why, as we war game, we want to make sure that we're doing all the right things, from technology to training to how we organize the formation, and different things like how you organize a formation with more or less artillery or with more or less mechanized infantry can really change the outcome on the battlefield. So we need to think through what that looks like. And then we keep running the war games until numbers come down until it's the other way around. So that's what we have underway now. You know, we talked earlier about, I can remember from my days when we deployed for Desert Shield, Desert Storm, we all predicted then, a lot of people predicted then the casualties for the Americans, the U.S. would be over 100,000, as I recall. And that turned out pretty well. So, and that was because you had courageous leaders in the Army in 1973 were willing to look back at Vietnam and say, we need to look forward to the future, and what do we need to fight and win in the future? And it's those leaders in 1973 who gave us air land battle doctrine. They gave us the big five weapon systems. They gave us a new way to train. They created the National Training Center. And it was unfortunate for the Iraqi Army in 1990-91 that they were the first ones to stand before that army, and you could see with what great success. And that's what we're trying to do now. We're trying to make sure, we coming out of 18 years of conflict, that we've now paused, we've taken a look at the past, we've taken a look at the future, we know what we need to do, and we want to, in many ways, replicate what those great leaders in 1973 did and built an army for the future that will be retain overmatch and be able to preserve the peace by being very, very capable on the battlefield.
And while I'm looking to call the next person, my friend in the ninth row here, a shameless self-promotion that I just put out a book this week, The Senkaku Paradox, in which I try to wrestle with some of these scenarios and try to keep them from getting to the kind of numbers you're talking about. Over to you.
Short summary was included. Yeah, okay, right. Good.
Is it on? Hi, Mr. Secretary. Melanie Sisson from the Stimson Center. Thanks for coming out to share your thoughts. I'm interested, the Army's made a big investment in Futures Command, both financially and otherwise, and I'm interested to know what leading indicators you'll be watching to assess whether or not AFC is performing well and doing the things, on track to do the things that the Army needs it to do.
Sure. I think, you know, the one that comes to mind immediately is timeliness in terms of requirements and things like that. Then, you know, the degree to which we can easily gain buy-in quickly because we have the CFTs organized. I'd probably put it under plate as well, although they don't own the entire process, would be, you know, at the end of the day, are you meeting, you know, cost, schedule, and performance for things that we determine we need to buy and buy? So, but the acquisition community plays a big role in that as well, so I can't put that all on AFC's plate. But I will tell you in terms of what I've seen so far, they are meeting the scheduled timeline. So we said a year ago, I testified, I said, I want our requirements process to go from what was 5 to 8 years down to 12 months to 18 months. And as I just said a few minutes ago, in terms of the FAR awards, you know, the requirements, we've got that out now in 13 months. It's pretty darn quick. Same thing with, you know, our night vision goggles, our new IVAS system we're doing, the requirements on next generation combat vehicle, much less time. And I think we've done that here in the first round in less than a year or so. So it's things that I look for. And it's just simple stuff. I mean, it used to be that there were 13 layers of command between where the requirements began and where they ended up. And now there's three. I mean, it's the CFT, it's Murray, and it's me and the chief. And so we're able to turn things real quickly. And issues that used to kind of stump the organization for months, if not years, the chief and I can just very quickly solve it. And so the first metric would be timeliness of those key things leading up to it. We could dig into it. I mean, we want to make sure, for example, that our S&T dollars that Army Futures Command is responsible for directing are aligned to our modernization priorities. And I will tell you, in terms of this budget we have going to the Hill, this budget will align, I think, 80% of our S&T dollars to that. So those are metrics that we look at to make sure that the entire modernization enterprise is unified and focused on the same things.
The gentleman here in the third row, please.
Thank you. Bill Veal, I'm a retired Army officer. I'm also retired Foreign Service. But I notice in your vision statement there are references to autonomous vehicles and
Right. Robotics. Right.
Looking ahead to your next year and a half, the studies you're doing on formations, if those studies point you to emphasize quantity, how do you feel about the state of the defense industrial base?
My sense is the industrial base is in good shape. I mean, we obviously have folks who work on that and monitor it, and we stay in touch. I talk to CEOs all the time. I had a meeting with one last night, and we take those inputs. And I think what I've heard from CEOs recently is what the Army's done in the budget has really been a shot in the arm for folks who are anxious to kind of get into the future, to really develop the robotics, the AI, and things like that. And it's an exciting, brave new world. I mean, the plan is to put have the capability to go semi-autonomous, if not fully autonomous, with all of our vehicles. And so if you think from a tactics perspective, just think what that does on the battlefield. I mean, if you had an autonomous tank force that were part of your tanks that could fix the enemy with unmanned vehicles and with minimal risk, certainly to people, but then you maneuver with a manned force, it gives you a great deal of capability. Or if I can get FARA, for example, my attack reconnaissance aircraft, I can get that unmanned. I worry less about the missions it conducts because I'm not putting pilots' lives in jeopardy. So those are the things we need to think about, is how do we reduce risk for the individual but enhance capability at the same time. And again, I think from what my talking to the industrial base, and then, you know, last week I was at the Georgia Tech Research Institute in Atlanta, outside Atlanta. I've been to Carnegie Mellon. They are all leaning forward. I think there's a lot of opportunity here for us to really make this big leap and move into the future.
Gentleman in the sixth row, there, please.
Hi, Matt Bainert from Defense Daily. This is just a quick question from a response from a few minutes ago on Option Manned Fighting Vehicle. I believe, I might have misheard this, but I think you said fielding around 2028. I believe the date we had heard before and what the Undersecretary had kind of talked about was 2026. So I was wondering, is 2028 the new goal? And
it's by 2028.
Okay, by 2028.
The vision talks about is we want to be deploying vehicles by 20, we want to be deploying new systems by 2028, and OMFV will meet that.
Okay, thank you.
We'll go over here to the fourth row and then the gentleman in the eighth row. Then we'll start to wind up here pretty soon.
I'm Steve Traver, retired Navy, and the excellent presentation we got yesterday about preventing major power conflicts over small stakes
was... That one of your points right there?
Was... that's part of the larger problem we're trying to work with regard to fighting in the gray zone, you know, just below the level of conflict, which is a variation on classical deterrence theory. You know, how do you prevent major war from starting in the first place, which involves a lot of people from the State Department. And the war plan associated with deterrence, particularly if you're trying to stop it in the gray zone, is a little different from the war plan we classically think of where we're going to engage the enemy directly, particularly from a logistical standpoint. My question is about the relationship between the creation of a strategic plan of the sort that you guys did an excellent job doing and the involvement of the State Department. Because the State Department people will typically look at the contribution of the military to helping them execute a deterrence theory type of strategy from a formulation standpoint. They're looking at the military from a very different standpoint in terms of its contribution compared to our classical engage and destroy sort of thing. When you wrote the plan, do you feel that you heard enough from the State Department on how they're going to be reacting when we get these gray zone sorts of threats of the sort that Michael sort of outlined yesterday? Do you think we need to, you know, strengthen that relationship at a congressional level so that when we talk about deterrence with conventional forces, we hear from the State Department and we hear from the military at the same time?
You have a lot packed in there. I'll just tell you that I feel my charge as Army Secretary is to build the most capable force I can with the dollars Congress gives me and the authorities I have. And I think to the degree if I can build the Army that we envision, that's captured in that vision, then what I'm actually doing is empowering the State Department, empowering our diplomats to do their job. Because now I've presented a force that one might should presume an enemy feels that they cannot successfully take on and defeat. So I want to deter conflict. I think that empowers our diplomats to do what they do best, engage and resolve issues peacefully, diplomatically. That's kind of how I view it. That's the prism by which through which I look through that lens.
And I think the last question will be the gentleman here. Microphone, please. Thanks.
I'm Chuck Day, Charles F. Day and Associates. I've been a prime at Fire Maneuver Support, INSCOM, RDEC. My question of you, though, has to do with educational attainment in the future of the workforce. We've got a modeling sim capability out of the Purdue Research Park, and when we do that work, we project that educational attainment is not going to be sufficient for the emerging technology requirements without micro-targeting. And when you talk about hitting the 22 mega centers and so on as the key to recruitment, how do you see the educational attainment requirements merging in the future with the Vision 2028?
Well, I'd be curious to see what your study says, but you know, our goal has always been to bring high school graduates into the force, and we have a very, very strong record of doing that, well over 90% on average, and I think our soldiers do very well in terms of their ability to understand the systems that we're trying to do on the battlefield. You know, obviously, also throughout the Army, we emphasize continuing one's education, and certainly for our NCO Corps and Officer Corps is professional military development. So all those things we need to work on. you know, my concerns when it gets to recruiting is to make sure I can find enough kids who are young men and women who are medically and physically fit enough to qualify the force, let alone serve. That's kind of the bigger challenge we wrestle with right now. Intellectually, I think they're fine, and I think we will always develop systems that they are capable of mastering and deploying on the battlefield. Particularly this generation. This generation has a lot more comfort and facility, if you will, with regard to complex information type of systems. So again, I've been less concerned about that than I have been about physical fitness and medical qualifications, and their willingness to join in the first place.
Please join me in thanking the Secretary of the Army.
Thanks, Mike.